tassa bhagavato arahato sammā sambuddhassa namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammā sambuddhassa namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammā sambuddhassa Buddhaṃ dhammaṃ saṅghaṃ namassāmi. Observance Day comes around, and these are always good occasions during the day when we have no formal communal work. We have a focus on refreshing our commitment to the precepts, our commitment to formal practice, seeking solitude, quietude for the day, and refreshing our sense of the basis of our life, our efforts, what we come together for as a community, whether it's for a day, a week, a lifetime, whatever it might be. So these upositas, these observance days, are really about that, observance, a kind of returning the attention to looking at what is essential, you know, the basis of our conduct and the basis of our meditation, the efforts that we are making to train these strange and unruly hearts of ours. And when I was leading this day-long meditation on Saturday, yesterday, one of the passages that I was referring to and that people found very striking was the expression of the Four Noble Truths as stated by Lumpo Dun, one of the great forest Ajahns, a disciple of Ajahn Mun, and his reformulation or recasting of the Four Noble Truths is a very direct and helpful way of working with the meditation and really establishing the basis of the essential Dhamma teaching, the kind of essence of what's happening and what to do about it. And as he describes, you know, the cause of suffering, dukkha, and we're used to the formulation of describing it as tanha, the different kinds of tanha, craving. He reformulates it as saying the mind which goes out in order to satisfy its moods is the cause of dukkha. So just to take that and to contemplate it is really potent for us, isn't it? Just to take that simple phrase, the mind which goes out in order to satisfy its moods is the cause of suffering. So this means that a hunger, an appetite, a gravitation has arisen, there's a pull, whether it's a painful feeling in the body, a headache, or whether it's an attractive sound or a nondescript sound, or whether it's a delicious flavor or fragrance, an interesting sight, or a frightening emotion, whatever it might be, whether it's the outness is not just out into the world of what we see and hear, but it's also out into a thought or a feeling or what we would call inside ourselves, or a factor of mind. But there's an appetite, there's a hunger, there's a gravitation, there's a sort of a drawing towards that. Not just in terms of liking, obviously, but a drawing towards going out to an annoying feeling, an itch on the skin, or a sound that we would prefer not to hear, or a pain in the back, or an obsessive thought. There's something that draws our attention to that, a force of habit, that it's been annoying before, or we've had an experience of if we react against it then we can get rid of it, or we've followed it before and there was a hit of gratification coming from that acquisition, that contact, that consuming. So a force of habit empowers that impulse to go out, the mind. And of course it doesn't really go out, the mind doesn't go anywhere, but the feeling is that of the sort of the energy of the mind leaving and going off and inhabiting this object, the memory, or the shape of the tree, or the form of the sound, whatever it might be. It goes out to satisfy its moods, to satisfy the mood that's arisen, the mood of longing, the mood of aversion, the mood of fear, the mood of interest, the mood of inspiration. Because it's not just unskillful objects that attract us, but even skillful ones. The wholesome and spiritually sort of noble objects can pull our attention as well. So there's that urge to satisfy the mood. There's the sense that in that movement, in that kind of absorbing into that, there's the heart buys into the logic of it. The heart buys into the, if I could just get rid of this headache, if I could just have a piece of that, if I could only keep that beautiful memory, that incredible feeling evoked by that moment, where there was just a pure exaltation. If I could just... So there's a buying into that logic, which is saying, if I just had this, if I just got rid of that, if only I wasn't being oppressed by X, Y, or Z, then everything in the world would be perfect. And this is the logic of Mara, the logic of desire. That's what happens. The universe shrinks to that size. We hear the sporadic ticking of the fan. We think, I can't be peaceful as long as the fan is ticking. And then we drift off and get absorbed into the breath, or wander off pursuing another fantasy. And then somewhere in the background we hear another click. You go, oh yes, I was annoyed about that fan, wasn't I? We've forgotten about that. But when the mind was focusing on it, had the universe had just shrunk to that. But it was a lie, wasn't it? Like the fan had been clicking all along and we were busy doing something else. It was insignificant after all. like this clock, this, if you pay attention to it, this clock ticks quite loudly. But, and so that if you wanted to, whenever you sit here with this clock in front of you, you could just sit and listen to the sound of the clock and be annoyed by it. I mean, we really need another clock. We have to have another clock. Why can't we get a clock in here that doesn't tick? But then, with time, you just don't notice it. So this is the lie of tanha. All of us are painfully familiar with. That's why we're here in a monastery, coming to train our hearts and to get beyond this, because we know it's a lie. That promise of, if this frightening thing wasn't here, if this uncomfortable relationship wasn't here, if this headache wasn't here, if this obsessive thought wasn't here, the weather was just a little bit different, then I would be happy. And then, as Lungpo Dun said, then the mind, the result of the mind having gone out to satisfy its moods, is dukkha, which is that as soon as we impute any kind of solidity, as soon as we generate that subject-object relationship, a me in here that's watching or experiencing a world out there, or absorbed in a thought within, but this is dukkha, intrinsically it's dukkha. There is, as soon as there is that solidity given to things, the heart is in a state of tension. There's division, there's the loss of the vision of Dhamma, the truly whole quality of reality has been lost. There's an in here, there's an out there, and there's a state of lack or an intrusion. Got to get rid of this, got to get a hold of that. The vision of Dhamma has been lost. At that moment, the heart doesn't recognize it's all Dhamma. There's this thing which is wrong, there's this thing which is missing, there's this thing which is extra. So this is dukkha, intrinsic in that. Now, as he says, the cure is the mind knowing the mind which knows the mind, is the way leading out of dukkha. The mind knowing the mind, the mind fully knowing the mind, is the way out of dukkha. So this is also illustrated for us in throughout the Satipatthana Sutta, the Buddha's main teaching on meditation. You know, over and over again, he talks about the amount of mindfulness that is needed to establish, to really establish the practice, to really establish the heart on the path, the amount of mindfulness necessary just to know what's going on. That amount of mindfulness that can know, this is a state of mind, this is a mood, this is a feeling, this is a conditionally arisen state. This is something which has come into being, doing its thing. The mind, clearly knowing the mind, is the way. So in this respect, it's excruciatingly simple for us, isn't it? Just as that going outness of the attention locking onto a sense object or a thought or whatever is the cause. Well, the solution is that unlocking, that letting go of, when the mind releases that and knows that, oh, this is just a state of mind. The mind clearly knowing the mind, knowing that this is a mental event. that longing, that fear, that aspiration, that irritation, that opinion. It's like knowing that this is the mind, this is the way of the mind, this is the activity of the mind. That quality of recognizing. And then in that recognition, there is intrinsically a letting go. We can't get absorbed in it. It's like once you remember, oh, this is a movie, this is just a story. Somebody made this up. This is only pretend. Then something changes in the heart, doesn't it? It's just like, this isn't for real. This is just a tale. It's not a true story. Something shifts within us. So this is exactly what we're doing with this the solution, the way beyond suffering is the mind clearly knowing the mind. It's like at this very moment, knowing that the feelings that we have right now of comfort or discomfort, heat or cool, the mood that we're experiencing, being tired, being alert, being interested, being bored, being inspired, being depressed, being restless, being settled, feeling joyful, feeling fragmented, whatever it might be, then the mind which knows this as mind is the way out of suffering. So whether we're feeling joyful or shattered or hot or cold, comfortable or uncomfortable, tired or perky, it's like, oh, this is a feeling, this is a mood, This is the way, isn't it? This is the way out of suffering. And just as we recognize that, every one of us knows, can see for ourselves how immediately effective that is. There's a shift. It changes its texture, it changes its quality automatically as soon as that kind of relaxation happens. This is the way beyond suffering. So this is a simple thing that we can see for ourselves, just in this very moment, that not going outness, when the, in a way, that kind of solidity is no longer being given to things, when we are remembering this is not a true story, this is just a tale. We can witness that transformation in the heart, that kind of returning homeness, coming back to the central point, coming back to reality. There's a natural, pure, simple quality to that, isn't there? There's a wholeness, an integrated quality to life that is not there when we're locked into that promise of got to get hold of this, want to get rid of that, more of this, less of that. But when there's that recognition, what is this? It's a quality of everything being in its place. As dukkha is probably best described as that feeling of out of orderedness, that feeling of somehow that the universe is out of order, that something needs to be kept hold of, something needs to be got rid of. Something shouldn't be quite the way that it is. This is what we mean by dukkha. So when we no longer send the attention out to absorb into this sort of making an intrinsically unsolid object solid, then we're coming back to reality. We're coming back to the vision of Dhamma. The heart knows that this is, everything is Dhamma. So there's this quality of integration, of it fits, there's a fittingness. Everything belongs. Even if the headache is still there, or the difficult relationship is still there, the hunger for that particular object, that food or drink or attractive person is still there, there's a recognition of what that is. Oh, this is just the attraction towards the beautiful. This is just irritation with the painful. And there's the heart knows, oh, this is all just Dhamma. This is just things coming into being, taking shape, doing their thing. Nothing is out of order. There's a rightness, sama. That's what this word means. It's like sama in samadhiti, sama sankapa, the eightfold path. That sama is kind of rightness or perfection or balancedness. And so we find the heart is sama when there's this mind truly knowing the mind. This is the cessation of dukkha. So we talk about this quality in a variety of different ways. We can talk about this as nibbana, or the unconditioned, the cessation of greed, hatred, and delusion, the island, the refuge, the beyond. Well, these different terms are all pointing to this very an ultimately simple natural quality of our own being that is inescapably present, like the earth beneath us, thing, or like Ajahn Chah would often use the example of groundwater, that you know, if you dig you'll find water. It's down there. You just have to keep digging far enough and you'll always find water. If you don't dig, you won't find the water. But if you do, there it will be. But if you dig 100 6-foot holes, you won't hit the water. But if you dig, you know, one hole 60 feet, definitely there'll be water down there. So this is exactly the same for us. It's not separate, or this quality of truth, this quality of true peace of heart. It's not escapable, it's not losable, it's not something that we can be truly separated from. It's just that ignorance and the habits of going out and pursuing thoughts and believing opinions and moods, trying to satisfy the moods, continually creates and recreates layers and layers of obscuration over this basic nature. Oh, when we remember to let go, to not send the heart out. But we know a mood is just a mood, and the mind really knows the mind, then we recognize that, yeah, the mind's nature is Dhamma. That's what the mind is Dhamma, the heart is Dhamma, it is that reality. And so that the meditation practice and all the aspects of our training and our daily lives and all the teachings, and they're all pointing towards this realization of this quality, realization of the Dhamma, knowing the Dhamma directly. And so we have a few pointers. You know, the Buddha avoided trying to talk a lot in sort of highfalutin philosophical language, but we have a few pointers just in the chanting that we do. Sanditiko, akaliko, ehipasiko, opanayiko, so on. Apparent here and now, timeless, encouraging investigation leading inward to be experienced individually by the wise. So this truth is it's always here and now, it's always here, it's always present. The heart is the heart of the universe. Your heart is the heart of the universe. It's the center of experience. It doesn't exist anywhere but now. It's always present. It's never separated in space or time. Encouraging investigation, opanaiko, means it's attractive. Ehipasiko, come and see. Leading inward, attractive. Ehipasiko. So the truth is draws our attention. The heart, in a way, longs to awaken to its own nature, to the true nature of things. So there's this kind of gentle secret gravitation that pulls the attention in past the different sense objects or thoughts or obsessions and moods. There's an even more powerful kind of quiet gravitation that draws all things to the Dhamma, as to their center. This is like the basic law that rules the universe. That, you know, in spite of all the distractions and confusions and whirling in samsara, there's this fundamental undercurrent, this gravitation of the Dhamma, of the truth. This we call the spiritual impulse, or the religious impulse. It's like that in us which knows, intuits, there is an ultimate reality, there is a Dhamma, there is a truth, and hungers to know that, hungers to awaken to that, to realize that. That's what draws us to a place like this. Also the other qualities, like the Ajahn Chah would describe the Dhamma in terms of purity, radiance and peacefulness, sawang, sa'at, sangu. These are the qualities of the Dhamma. Purity, radiance, peacefulness. But when the heart is free of clinging, these are the qualities it possesses. So much of the meditation, our practice, is to just train the heart to awaken, to not go out and absorb into things, but to rest in these qualities of purity, peacefulness, knowing, empty, radiant. So there's these qualities that are the basic attributes of the unconditioned mind: limitlessness, knowing, brightness. These are all just adjectives that can point roughly in the way of the reality, and kind of allude to that quality in some way, shape or form, that can only kind of partially represent that. So that we're guiding with all of the different techniques that we use, the sitting meditation, and doing mindfulness of breathing, or reciting buddho, or doing metta practice, you know, insight practice, contemplation of the body, you know, sweeping, body sweeping, the recollection of the 32 parts, all of the different things that we do are really fundamentally geared to sustaining this capacity that the mind has to awaken to its own nature, to the Dhamma itself, and to rest in it, to know that fully and completely. So we can talk of this, of the knowing, as the Buddha mind, the one who knows. And that which is known by the Buddha is the Dhamma. So we have, it's the purpose of all of the meditation and practice is simply to go from transforming our sort of way of seeing things and holding things as me living here in a monastery, you know, doing my practice, and me committed to Theravada Buddhism, or me living in this monastery for a while, doing my thing and helping out this way and that way, me and my life, me and my hopes, me and my problems. Yeah, as Ajahn Sumedho would often say, it's we're making it a paradigm shift from that, you know, me and my world, to the Buddha mind, seeing the way things are, the Buddha seeing the Dhamma, the one who knows, the quality of knowing, of this very attribute of awareness functioning right here now, attending to this moment. The Buddha knowing the Dhamma, knowing the way things are. And in that kind of the simplicity of that shift, letting go of the personal perspective, letting go of subject and object, of in here and out there, me watching a thought, me looking at the room, then there is as a quality of true peace, of true integration, a quality of rightness, of wholeness, samma, balance. And this is really all we need to do, just making that, remembering to make that shift to the Buddha mind, knowing the way things are. And in the beginning, this is just a fragment, a moment, an instant here and there of that clarity and simplicity. But this is why we practice. This is why we make commitments over time. This is why we train. It's not just a one flash experience, but just that ongoing training, whereby more and more deeply and completely we shift the habit of following moods, trying to satisfy our moods, and train the heart just to rest in this pure, simple quality of awareness, of knowing. And then feeling the delight of the way things are. That when the heart awakens to the Dhamma, the experience of that is delight. Nibbana is the supreme happiness. It's not a kind of bland or disappointing quality. There's an effervescence, a great brightness, a joy in the heart when the Dhamma is really recognized. There's absolutely nothing missing. Everything is absolutely okay. There's an extraordinary, wonderful, amazing rightness that becomes that much more apparent because of having lived for so many hours, so many days, weeks, months, years with the feeling of not quite rightness or highly not rightness, definitely wrongness. So much of the practice then is training the heart to be content with this simplicity, that there's always a dozen, a thousand things that pop up that look like they're more important to do, or a kind of interesting additions or sidetracks. But the aim and the purpose of having like observance days, retreat times, formal meditation is to keep pulling this extraordinarily simple principle right to the center, in the spite of everything, in the face of everything. Just as long as we keep this one simple gesture at the very center of our attention, then the other aspects of our life can supplement that, can support that. But there's so many other things that pull us out to be more real, more significant. This particular journey, or this particular project, this particular thing that needs to be built, or written, or cooked, or repaired, or discussed, or figured out, or got rid of. That's what we're really here to do. That's what that's what's really important around here. This is when we feel the heart moving in that direction. This is exactly what Lumpur Dun points out as the core. This is the cause of suffering. That sense of what we really need to do around here is, what we really need is, yeah, more trails, better kitchen, more organized bookkeeping. We need to know where the crack in the pipe is. That's the priority, the water system. We've got to get that straightened out. This is the heart moving out to satisfy its moods. So just to encourage us all, just to keep this, to remember that what we're aiming to do here is extraordinary, excruciatingly simple. Just this very plain, extremely ordinary gesture shifting the perspective to the Buddha mind, seeing the way things are, the Buddha knowing the Dhamma, and then letting the heart rest in that. Because in the beginning, at first, it just doesn't seem like anything. Peace does not grab our attention. It's not exciting. But it's like you just train the heart to rest with that. And it's like almost like the sort of the color flowing into a black and white picture. Or like the dawn when the color comes back into the world as the sunlight appears. It's like, oh look, greens, blues, reds, hadn't noticed that the colours weren't there. So just train the heart to rest with peace, to rest in nirvana, rather than overlooking that because it doesn't seem very interesting or very special. Just stopping with that emptiness, that spaciousness, that undefinedness, resting with that, and then witnessing the effect of that. Not filling ourselves up with the next thing that needs to be done, but just letting the heart rest with that, and just watching the color flowing into the picture. It's like, oh, ah, it's like the heart comes alive. So this takes restraint, but this is supremely worthwhile. And just then we can see for ourselves the effect of that, just training the heart to rest in that spacious, open, knowing quality, and then just feeling that sense of the color, the life, gently flooding into it, flowing into it, and then like, oh, aha, a sense of liveliness and brightness, of vitality Like, so Nibbana is not just a blank space, it's a completely sort of vibrant living peace. It's not just like a frozenness or a kind of dead quietude. There's a vitality, a vibrancy that's there that we miss if we're too, if we overlook that quality. The attention just racing on to the next significant thing. Just resisting those urges to grab something, to investigate, chase after something, and or just drift off into a doze. To stay open, letting that space be fully known, that absence of dukkha be fully known. Then we witness that transformation for ourselves as a kind of adornment or flowering of the heart that we find that when that's really the more and more completely we allow that attention to the spaciousness, the deathless, to be established. Amen.